This is Jessica Taylor interviewing Mr. Lee Butka Jr. on March 3rd, 2011 for the Samuel Proctor Oral History Program at the University of Florida. Lee Butka was born on November 10th, 1921. His highest rank achieved was captain in World War II in the United States Army. And I'm going to let him talk right now. And this interview is being conducted for the Veterans History Project in the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress.
Thank you, Jessica. When I was in college in the 1930s, I, of course, had to take 2 years of basic ROTC training. And I opted to take advanced training because it was pretty clear by 1937 or 38 that we were going to be in a war. I thought we were. And if we were going to be in a war, I wanted to be an officer. The pay was better and I could give orders as well as take them. So that happened. And I was called to active duty in March of 1942 at Fort Eustis, Virginia. And then in April, we were transferred, I was one of those, transferred to Camp Hewlin, which is near Palacios, Texas. And the GIs down there had a saying that Palacios meant, of course, it actually means palace, but the GIs all said it meant up to your butt in mud and choking on dust, and you only could raise two things in that part of Texas: Brahma cattle, which are immune to a lot of the insect bites, and soldiers. We trained in the 436 automatic weapons, anti-aircraft artillery battalion, semi-mobile. And one of the things that happened to me there, they wanted to make a rocket scientist out of me in 2 days. I went to a two-day rocket school. Now, these were target rockets. They were things about, they were structures about 8 or 10 feet tall with great big fins. The idea was to fire them up because they would travel faster than an airplane could pull a sleeve target, and give us practice shooting at fast-moving things. So when I came back, the colonel said, "Bidgood, what did you learn at this school?" And I said, "Well, sir, the most important lesson was before you fire one of these rockets, dig yourself a good deep hole and get down in it, because sometimes they malfunction." And he appreciated that. Our primary weapon at that time was a 37-millimeter automatic cannon, which was an American product, and it wasn't any good. After 3 or 4 rounds, they would break down, and there was a part that you couldn't repair in the field. It had to go to a machine shop. So, luckily, we got 40-millimeter Bofors. Although just a few weeks before we went into, before we embarked for our combat. The Bofors was a Swedish cannon, which was very reliable, and we got quite used to handling them. On August 11th, I was promoted to first lieutenant. And one of the things that happened was a hurricane came in to Camp Hewlin, and the colonel put me in charge of the trucks that were left behind. All the personnel was evacuated to inland, someplace in Texas, I forget just where. And I stayed with the trucks there until I noticed that the railroad ties that we had used to chock the trucks to keep them from rolling, the railroad ties were beginning to blow around in the parking lot. And I said, it's time to go. So we got in and went, drove out to the where the battalion was headquartered. We finally found them in a cotton warehouse, and they were bunked down in on cotton bales. So when we got back the next day, the hurricane was long gone, but all of our tents had been blown away. There was just the concrete bases left, and the hospital was pretty much intact. It was a strong brick structure, but it was full of driftwood and mud because all of that had blown in from Matagorda Island, which is offshore there. And the only trouble about that was the driftwood was crawling with rattlesnakes. So cleaning up the hospital was quite a thing. Well, we were shipped by train from Hewlin to a place on the coast in North Carolina, and I forget the name, where we practiced with our 40-millimeter guns for the first time. My platoon scored a hit on the target sleeve, but the only one scored. Then we went to the Hampton Roads port of debarkation for a few more drills before we got on a ship to go somewhere. We didn't know where, of course. And there, we had an ideal soldier. He was not in my battery or platoon, but this kid was from the Midwest, upper Midwest. He had been an outdoorsman and a hunter, and he took great care of his M1 rifle, which was a standard issue for he even sharpened his bayonet. Well, one day, he stayed back when the rest of his unit were out training. He sat down on his bunk, took that sparkling clean rifle, put the butt between his feet and the muzzle in his mouth, and blew his brains out. So you never know what to expect with soldiers. We embarked on October the 23rd on the Tasker H. Bliss. She was a former flagship of the Dollar Line, the President Cleveland Dollar Line. She was called the President Cleveland. And we left from Hampton Roads. This was actually the shakedown cruise for this modified passenger liner. Shakedown cruise is normally when the crew, in this case, these were green Coast Guard guys, some of them younger than me, although I was only 20 at the time. they would take a shakedown cruise normally and figure out what needed to be fixed on a ship that was recently modified, and usually there were a lot of things. Well, we had all kinds of problems on the Bliss. The ventilation system was very poor, and we were seasick. A lot of us were. I was seasick, although I never threw up. But the guys down in the holds did, and the hold stank with vomit. I dreaded going down in there, of course, had to. And I was bunked in a stateroom with seven other officers, so I was relatively comfortable. And one of the things that happened while we were on board was we were issued bazookas. Now, the bazooka was named after, I think it was Bob Burns, who had a funny-looking wind instrument that was a long pipe, and these things looked like that. So actually, they were rocket launchers. And of course, I was the rocket scientist, having been 2 days training. And so I had to instruct. And the main thing I insisted on, with both there on ship and later on land, when practicing with those things or using them, be sure your helmet strap is unbuckled and wear goggles. Otherwise, you're going to lose your eyes, probably, or you might. Because as the rocket launches out of the bazooka, there's a blowback from it. And that's why it will often knock your helmet off. That's why you want the strap tightened. And you want to wear goggles. I made myself somewhat unpopular with the Coast Guard crew because one night on inspection, after the smoking lamp was out, which means you don't smoke after dark, and you only smoke on deck anyhow, so we went into the hold where the Coast Guard crew were, and the smoke was so thick that you could hardly see. So I turned them in on report, and that didn't improve my popularity. Well, our destination was the Moroccan town of Fedala. We call it Fedala. And it is about 18 miles north of Casablanca, and it was held by the Vichy French, who at that time were working with the Germans. And we were supposed to go in there. Meanwhile, we were in the Western Task Force, commanded by a general named George Patton. And he was on the cruiser Augusta. But there was a huge convoy, the largest convoy, I think, of the war, maybe. But there was word that our generals were trying to negotiate a peaceable arrival. And the word was, if it was better up, and I may have this reversed, if it was better up, it'd be peaceful. Play ball, we'd go in shooting. Those are the two radio signals. But on the Bliss, in addition to our 436 AA battalion, we had a reconnaissance company from the 3rd Division, famous 3rd Division, Rock of the Marne Division. And these guys, they called themselves snoopers. They were an insurance policy. They were going to sneak ashore and paddle ashore in rubber boats before H hour, an hour or two before H hour, with their sharp knives, kill the French sentries and disable their coastal guns. And that was their plan. Okay, I had finished everything I could do getting my platoon ready to be launched. We were going to go in small boats. We called them Higgins boats because they were made by Higgins. But they were actually, they have different names now. But I had done all I could done, and around 12 o'clock that night, I stretched out on my bunk, fully dressed, of course, with my Tommy gun, which was my weapon, by my side, and went sound asleep. Next thing I know, the duty sergeant is shaking me and said, "Lieutenant, wake up, wake up. The Navy says they don't know where we are." I said, "How in the hell can a 28,000-ton ship, the largest transport in the convoy, get lost from the middle of a convoy?" Well, it was a rhetorical question. Both of us knew that anything was going to go wrong. It could and probably would on the Bliss. So I hurried up on deck, and by that time, the our crew spotted a British destroyer way out to sea offshore from where we were. And we used the blinkers, semaphore signal, and said, "Where are we?" And the answer came back, and it's burned into my brain. It said, "What the hell are you doing there? You're in the middle of a French minefield off Casablanca." So it was an uneasy moment. We backed out slowly, trying to go back the same way we'd come in. And then we headed north to our assigned position, Fatala. And by the time we got there, the word had come to go in fighting, and our three battleships with 14 and 16 inch guns were cruising up and down and blasting the shore with 14, 16 inch guns. It was very impressive. The noise and the flashes. I'd never been around a weapon bigger than about 155 millimeter or six, which is what we trained on at one point. And so I remember saying something to my buddy Lou Young. I said, well, I guess we lost the element of surprise. And so it was mass confusion. The sea was rough. Crazy Quartermaster Corps and the Army had all of our troops wearing leggings over heavy brogans, Army heavy shoes. And the sea was rough, and our small boats tended to turn sideways in the surf and dump soldiers and all equipment. And although the soldiers had these inflatable life belts, some cases they worked, some cases they didn't, they couldn't get their shoes off, the heavy shoes, and many of them were tumbled around on rocks and cut and dead and drowned. And some of the small boats were under the charge of a Coast Guard coxswain, young guy, inexperienced. When they saw the fire coming from shore, machine gun and cannon fire, they wouldn't go in. And in one or two cases, a third division lieutenant had to pull his 45 and say, you're going to shore. And some got terribly lost. Three or four boatloads of MPs got as lost as the Bliss had and wound up in Casablanca Harbor, and the French saw them in open fire with machine guns and 20 millimeter cannons, and killed two or three dozen of them, wounded some more, and others were captured. Some escaped, and French civilians pulled them out of the water and gave them coats and looked after them. But that was typical. We described it, well, anyhow, by noon of that day, 67% of our landing craft had been destroyed, either in the surf or by French fire. And so we were not going ashore. We were supposed to go ashore in the third wave, but the much higher priority for the infantry. And we all described it as a snafu. You know what a snafu is. Well, it had gone from snafu to janfu, joint Army-Navy foul-up. That's a janfu. And from there to fubar, fouled up beyond all recognition. And that was a situation. And eventually, finally on November the 10th, by now the little port there, it was a tiny harbor of Fedora, had been taken by our troops. And so the small boats could go right in, out of the surf, and we unloaded all of our guns, our fire control equipment, little power plants that ran everything, and one Jeep per battery. Our trucks were still on the Bliss, and we had an unloading detail on the Bliss, about a dozen men and an officer. And I put my platoon's guns on a hill overlooking the anchorage. We called it Dead Man's Hill because it had been bombarded by the Navy and our dive bombers from the carrier. And although the bodies are hauled away, there's been heavy artillery and bombing. Pieces of flesh are left in trees and on fences and places that smell. That's why we call it Dead Man's Hill. Well, the next day, we got word that a ceasefire, that was November the 11th, a ceasefire had been arranged, and the French were no longer enemies. And it was a good thing because Patton's north and south, he had a task force going in at Safi, which is quite a bit south, as I recall, about 200 miles or more south of Casablanca, and Port Leote, which is maybe 80 miles to the north. Well, they had been relatively successful. Resistance had been slight compared to where we were, and they had advanced, but they all ran out of gas. Patton was not known for his use of logistics and planning. And so that afternoon, we were sitting around eating a turkey, which one of our guys had shot and wandering around. It was obviously a tame turkey, but it was good food. We were enjoying that, and I was looking down at our ships, and all of a sudden, I'm looking at the Bliss. Two columns of smoke and fire erupt from the Bliss. We knew what it was, torpedoes. Two torpedoes hit her. And then one torpedo hit another transport, and another torpedo hit another transport, and all three. Well, that was evening. The Bliss soon broke out in fire and explosions. And there was oil all over the water on fire. We could only watch. And I remember at the time, it seemed unreal. Those were toy ships down there. They didn't have live people on them. It was a newsreel. It was horrible. And at daylight, I rushed down to the field hospital to see if I could find any of our unloading detail had been on the Bliss. Well, all of the casualties in the field hospital had been in burning oil, and their heads were swollen, their faces were swollen, you couldn't recognize anybody. And I was too dumb to try to check dog tags, which would usually be hanging. So I just left. I said, I can't find any of our guys. As it happened, none of our guys were in that hospital. One fella slid down a rope and plunged through the oil, swam. He was a good swimmer, swam underwater till he got beyond the burning oil and got ashore in fine shape. Then he realized that he didn't have any skin left on the palms of his hands because he'd slid down a rough rope and abraded his palm. But it turned out that you don't get it. The other members of our loading detail had gotten off the ship and were picked up by a transport that was unharmed, which hastened back to the States, zigzagging, unescorted. These guys had already been torpedoed once. And that's a nervous trip. They got back to New Jersey, and I forget which fort it was where they kept them. But they were held incommunicado. They weren't allowed to telephone or write or communicate with their families. They were kept there for two, 3 weeks or so. And then they were put on another ship and sent back again, scared to death that they'd be torpedoed. When they got to us, they were mental cases. And most of them got Section 8 discharges, which is, we got fancy names for all that now. In those days, it was shell shock or mental affection. But you can imagine the mental strain of being torpedoed and then making two trips across the ocean. So,
can I ask how that affected you personally?
Mm-hmm. Excuse me?
Can I ask how that affected you personally?
Well, it was horrible. It was about the worst thing I saw in the whole war. So it introduced me to the madness and confusion, mass confusion and horror of warfare. And I confess that my greatest fear as I was getting ready to land and make the invasion was that I would be too nervous or fail to take care of my duties and jeopardize the people under my command. Well, I really didn't find out how I would react under severe strain. But I guess I got a little more confident that I could do my job. I don't know. So we were ashore now with our guns and fire equipment and one Jeep per battery. So we were issued some transport to take the place of our lost trucks. On the way over, our convoy had intercepted a French freighter, which was loaded with about 60 old vehicles. They were old Citroëns, I remember. I don't remember some of the other brand names, familiar names. European-made trucks. But they were all modified to run on charcoal. They had charcoal burners that generated gas, which and the engines had been modified. So they issued us some of these trucks. Well, our guys did a good job of converting them back to using gasoline. I don't know how they did it, but they somehow did it. And they would run for a while. They'd break down a lot. But so with those and their Jeeps, we managed to get down to a bivouac area outside of Casablanca. And we were waiting for trucks, the parts would be shipped over, and then they'd be assembled at a location outside of Casa. In a way, we were lucky to have lost our trucks, because another anti-aircraft unit, which was self-propelled, they had moved on with the army and got into that horrible situation at Kasserine Pass. You may have heard about that, which was a debacle. And so they had casualties and so on. Lost some to were captured. So we're sitting there in Casablanca. Well, eventually, by then it was maybe April, we got our trucks, the replacement trucks, so we started out in convoy. One of the tasks we had along the way was just to guard an airport. And there was a British unit there when we arrived. Now, we were all wearing wool, OD, olive drab, long sleeves, long pants, uniforms in terrible weather. That was the quartermaster's idea of what you wore in the desert. Luckily, I had written home and said, I remember I had sent home my khaki uniforms, cotton uniforms that we used in Texas, and my parents mailed it to me, and so I had some khakis, but I was the exception. And our tents were pyramidal, dark color, like ovens. Well, the British uniforms were different, and the Brits' tents were different, and British officer noticed our guys out there and noticed me and sent his orderly, they call him the Batman, over to invite me over to his tent for a drink. Not wanting to offend an ally, I accepted. And the tent was light tan. It had a fly which provided some air insulation. And it also had a ground cloth which kept the dust from blowing around into food or drink. And we sat there, and this British officer looked out at our guys in their dark uniform. Most of them had taken off their shirts. They were in the sun, but they were sweating like you wouldn't believe. And this British officer remarked, he says, "You know, you Yanks have a saying that war is hell, and then by God you turn around and try to make it so." That remark stuck. Well, eventually we got out to the front, which by then was in Tunisia. Nothing much happened there. We didn't have any targets. I did have one little expedition. We had one gun that got wrecked, and my Jeep driver and I drove all night to a supply dump, picked up the gun, and got back home to our base, to our headquarters, with a replacement 40mm Bofors by daylight. But one of the things that happened, we were then stationed at on Cape Bon, which is a cape opposite Sicily. And our next target was going to be Sicily, although we didn't know it. but I was distressed at one sight. The air base there had, with their I think at that time our Air Corps was flying mostly Spitfires. It's better. We had P-39s, which they called flying coffins because they were so heavy and difficult to land. But anyhow, there was going to be an inspection, an Air Corps inspection. A general was coming in to inspect the air base there. And they lined up all of those airplanes and sprayed them with aviation gasoline to wash the dust off of them. Well, every day we were getting stars and stripes frequently. We knew that tankers were being torpedoed and lost, bringing fuel to us. I just couldn't understand how they could waste that aviation gasoline. But that was one of those things. And eventually, we loaded up. We were sent back to Bizerte, and we loaded on an LST, landing ship tanks, all of our guns. And at that time, we used to enjoy listening to Axis Sally. She was a former American who had gone over to the Axis side and was in Italy and would broadcast, supposedly, causing consternation. Actually, we just thought she was funny. And this one night, I remember she says, "Well, boys, I see that you've got your ships loaded in Bizerte, and we will be waiting for you. I will be glad to see you, and I'm not a virgin, you know." We roared at that, and there was one air raid. It was reconnaissance, but anyhow, some of the heavier weapons, we couldn't shoot high altitude. The 40 millimeter has a maximum range of about 2,000 yards at the most, and the shells self-destruct at 3,500 yards, so they don't land on your own people and cause problems. Anyhow, this one plane was shot down. So then we started out. I should mention, I'm getting ahead of myself, that on our way toward Tunisia on May the 12th of that year, 43, the Africa Corps surrendered. And that was about, I've seen different numbers, 225,000 to 275,000. These were elite German soldiers. They were the cream of the German army. They were all tall, blonde guys, the Aryans, they called them. And there were hundreds of them streaming back. We were seeing them passing by. Some of them were driving their own trucks. We picked up one guy, put him on the hood of our Jeep and took him, because he had been wounded and couldn't walk very well, and took him back to the prison compound where you get medical attention. But it made me realize that our reputation for treating prisoners well helped, because these guys were still quite active, unlike the Japanese, which we had heard about and read about, who would fight to the death. I might not have made it if these guys had been willing to fight to the death, because they were all healthy looking. And it was just that their supplies had been cut off and they were surrounded. The 8th Army was coming up from the Egypt direction, and we were coming in from Algiers and into Tunisia. So they had surrendered. And again, nowadays, I hate to see reports where we've been mistreating prisoners. It doesn't make sense. If you treat prisoners well, they're more willing, your enemy is more willing to surrender.
What did you hear about Germans before you met one?
What did I hear about them? They were just soldiers. I knew about the concentration camps and that they hated Jews, and that was unfortunate. You know, our colonel was of German origin, Major Schutz, Colonel Schutz, and spoke good German. He had been a first sergeant in World War I. But I didn't have one feeling one way or another about Germans. They were just soldiers. And same way about Italians. Okay, we launched out of Bizerte on our LST. And the LST is an interesting vessel to me because it's a long thing, 5,500 tons, and it has no keel, so it really rolls. And also, if you're in the stern, you can look toward the front and you could see it bending a little in the middle as it hits waves. And I am susceptible to, I get large boat seasickness. There are two kinds of seasickness, large boat and small boat. And they're different. And I'm fine with small boats. I learned that. I had it demonstrated when we were training for the next invasion, when we were stationed there at Cape Bon. We traveled in an LCT, landing craft tank, and it has high walls, but it rolled and it pitched, and I was not bothered, but my whole crew was vomiting, and it couldn't get over the walls, so it was all down in the bilge, and the thing stank. But again, I found out I don't get seasick. I always like to fish on small boats. Maybe that's why. I don't know. But I don't get seasick. But LSTs, that's seasickness. But they gave me some pills, I don't know what they were, which helped. And we then, once we were at sea in the Mediterranean, we had a meeting, and the intelligence officers got out maps, showed us we were going to Sicily, and oh my God, there are three German divisions on Sicily. There are over 200,000 Italian troops manning the coastal fortifications. I don't know how we're going to do that. But anyhow, we were assigned to land at Licata, which is a small town port west of Gela, where the main force would land. And we went ashore unopposed, uneventful. And I at that time, I was the battery exec, number two in the battery. And I stayed out on the jetty. We had two guns on the jetty, a 50 caliber machine gun, water cooled on a tripod, and a 40 millimeter Bofors. And I had always nagged our guys, no matter where they sighted their guns, they would either dig a hole or build a parapet around it. And so they had worked hard from daylight, time we landed, for hours building parapets, filling sandbags over on the beach with plenty of sand and hustling them back out on the jetty and building parapets. So anyhow, mid-afternoon I'm out there watching on the jetty because I had better visibility there than some, and I could use my field glasses. And I happen to be looking out over the water, and here comes the round nose, bright yellow, of a Focke-Wulf 190 fighter bomber, and just skimming over the water. He wasn't 20 feet off the water. And luckily, my buddy Lou Young, lieutenant, was standing next to the 50 caliber machine gunner, and I yelled as loud as I could at Lou and pointed out on the water, and he saw what I saw, and he slapped the gunner and pointed, and the gunner was wide awake and opened fire immediately on this Focke-Wulf. And that noise all of a sudden was quiet till then, attracted the attention of all of the Navy on the transport that was being unloaded in the little harbor, and all of our trucks, every unit used 2.5-ton GMC trucks, and most of them had an opening over the passenger seat, front seat, and a 50 caliber air-cooled machine gun mounted. And so all of those guys all started opening up. And the firing was tremendous. And this pilot coming in pulled up in preparation of dropping his bombs. He missed. I don't know where the bombs landed. But he climbed on up, but he had been hit and bailed out. And of course, his plane crashed. But then I found, then we had other Focke Wulfs coming in, trying to bomb and strafe us. And they were met with very heavy fire by our guns and all the other firepower in the area. And finally, it quieted down. And I went to our 40 millimeter and found that they had taken a direct hit in the parapet. Now, luckily, these are relatively small bombs that these fighter bombers carried, probably 50 kilograms, 110 pounds, with delayed action fuses designed to, the bomb was designed to penetrate the deck of a transport and explode down in the hole where all the ammunition and fuel and other supplies were. And they had been successful in other areas in blowing up transports that way. One bomb would do it if you hit the deck. Well, this bomb went down into the sandbags and exploded. The concussion knocked out three guys who, they were out cold, didn't seem to be hurt much otherwise, and they were flown back to Bizerta to the hospital. But I was glad and felt gratified for all the times I'd nagged the guys to build their parapets, because had they not had that parapet, the whole crew would have been wiped out by that bomb exploding on the concrete deck. Well, by late afternoon, we didn't see any more fighters come in. And I looked out on the water, and I saw a lot of fish had been stunned. And I looked at them, and they looked to be mullet. And I'd always liked mullet, provided they were very, very fresh. So without thinking much about it, I slipped out of my clothes, grabbed an empty sandbag, and swam out there and filled a bag full of mullet, and came back. One of our guys said, some fellow says, who is that fool swimming out there where he's liable to be in the water when the bomb goes off? And the guy looked at him and said, that fool is our battery exec. And we had a good fish fry that night, which was a lot better than Army rations. Of course, it was foolish to go out there because the water's the worst place you can be if a bomb drops in the water. But after everything, by dark, I went to my CO and said, sir, I recommend that we do no firing tonight. Our guns, we don't have any searchlights here. There are no 90 millimeters that would have, and any air raid is apt to be at high altitude, which is out of range anyhow. If we fire, all we'll do is outline the position and help to light the position for any enemy aircraft. He agreed with me, and orders were issued, no firing after dark. Well, I was tired. I'd been seasick a lot up most nights, and I went to bed, went to bunk down, and we were in a warehouse, and I was in the upper floor, and I didn't wake up till the next morning. Well, during the night, there was an air raid. Didn't wake me up. One bomb landed next to our battalion headquarters and killed one guy. And I didn't know about that till morning. And after that, the 82nd Airborne was flying in to drop paratroopers to cut off some of the enemy lines back of them, help kind of surround them. And lousy communications. We didn't know anything about it. The Navy didn't get the word. And they opened fire. The Navy opened fire on these planes and knocked down a bunch of them. And next morning I checked and I found out that one of our crew said, yeah, we fired four rounds. A lieutenant colonel jumped in the gun pit and said, shoot down those planes. Even though we had orders not to, we obeyed him. He was a West Pointer, incidentally. And they fired four rounds, and I checked their ammunition, and that was true. And none of the others had fired, so I was glad of that. But then later on that day, there were some guys in a, I don't know if they were life rafts, life preservers or what, were coming in, and some characters out on the jetty were saying, shoot those guys. Wait a minute, wait, ho. It turned out they were 82nd Airborne guys that had been shot down by the Navy that were coming in. Somebody wanted to shoot at them. You know, people get excited in combat and want to shoot something. But the other interesting thing was, I guess it was 2 days later, I'm a little hazy on time span. I remember things, but I don't remember the exact dates. But anyhow, our infantry reported that they weren't meeting much resistance. There were pillboxes, and they would fire one round. Usually a white phosphorus would make a lot of smoke, and all the Italians would come out waving white flags. And there was a huge line of Italian soldiers surrendering, and the officers had their bags packed like they were going on vacation. And some of my guys were saying, "Oh, Italians are coward." Well, I didn't say anything, but I'm thinking they've got too much sense to fight for the Hitler and Benito Mussolini. And they knew they were going to be well treated. Again, the value of treating prisoners well, reputation. They're willing to surrender to you when they've got a choice. And the other thing I remember specifically about Sicily, well, more than one, they, I don't know, somewhere along the way, we were bivouacked, and we always had a chow line, and at the end of the chow line would be a garbage can to take leftovers. And a bunch of women and children showed up, begged us to put our leftovers into, they had empty cans and things, rather than in the garbage can. They were hungry. And it reminded me of something I had seen in North Africa at one point, and I don't remember where, but a starving Arab came up begging for food. And somebody gave him a can of sea rations. Well, you open sea rations, you pry up, and this guy couldn't wait to dump it out. He tried to get into it, and his face was all cut up trying to eat out of that can. It made an impression on me, as did those hungry women and children in Sicily.
What were, personally, what were your interactions like with civilians in Italy?
Very little interaction, but they were not hostile. They just seemed resigned. Whatever was going on. When we got to Patton, of course, disobeyed orders and broke through and got to Palermo, which was the main port on the north side of Sicily. And we were assigned there. And we met friendly Sicilians there, interacted with them. I even went to an opera, an opera house. It was the first time I'd ever been to an opera. It was interesting. And some of our guys went to the catacombs where all of these people were buried and preserved centuries ago. I'd seen enough dead. I didn't go there. But I guess it was interesting. And I had one gun on top of Monte Sano, I think it was called, but it was a TB sanitarium location, but this was a high, rocky hill. Made a good sight for a gun, good, you know, clear range you could see. And but it was practically solid rock. Well, to dig a pit, that was difficult, but we had a guy called Dynamite. His nickname was Dynamite Jones. He was very good with explosives, and he would put blocks of TNT together and a detonator and blast a hole. Well, he was blasting a hole there, and my tent was not far away. All of a sudden, somebody comes into my tent. It's a British officer. He's got a cut on his head and blood streaming down his face, and he says, "I say, this blasting has got to cease." Because the rocket hit him on the head. So we ceased. Luckily, we had dug enough to get the gun in. And, then we got orders that we're going to be shipped to the UK, to England, presumably to participate in some invasion of the continent at some point. We didn't know when, of course. But we had our barracks bags stenciled and loaded on the ship, and we were just about to load on, and some genius back in running things in England or Berserdi or somewhere decided, why send this 436 AAA battalion by ship through the Mediterranean, gauntlet of submarines, and so on, and England? We've got AA units in England. Maybe they don't have the experience, but that's not worth all that much. So our orders were canceled. Well, then what happened? I said we were not a lost battalion. We were a misplaced battalion. They lost track of us. And I say that because we sat around and we were attached to the Peninsula Base section, and they were delighted to have a combat unit attached to them. Oh, they were proud of us, but we weren't that great. But we were near Termini Imerse, which was a hot spring. Termini Imerse means warm immersion in Italian. And you could take hot baths in there. Boy, it puts you to sleep, hot, salty bath. And the only other thing happened, I got high fever, which my doctor, my medic, thought was dengue, because that's called breakbone fever, and that's what it felt like. And I wouldn't go to the hospital. I stayed in my pup tent, and I got over it okay after a few days. But I still don't know if it was dengue. It was never verified. But anyhow, one day, the three guys who had been knocked out at the gun sight on the jetty showed up. And they said, we sure are glad to find you. We were sent to Italy, and we traveled all around. We couldn't find 436 anywhere. And so we finally decided to come back to Sicily to look for you. So they did. Well, almost the next day, we got orders to move. They found us. The misplaced battalion was located. I swear they didn't know where we were, because otherwise they wouldn't have sent those guys up to Italy. They could have sent them to England, because we did have orders to go there. But that's some of the confusion of war. So, by soon, all of the Germans were chased off of Sicily, and the Italians had either surrendered or disappeared. Some of these towns we passed through, you'd see a lot of army boots lined up, Italian army boots, and a lot of civilians around. So, we were sent in France. We traveled by an LST to southern France, which has already been completely liberated. And we would convoy up to the front somewhere in the eastern part of France. One thing, I was talking to a nurse on the LST, which carried us to southern France, and she said they had ferried a French colonial unit, these Gumes and Gumiers, as they were called, or Senegalese. There were three different kinds. Now, the Gumes were Algerian, the Gumiers were Moroccans, or vice versa, I don't remember. And of course, the Senegalese, they were dark guys. And she said, these Arabs had an interesting time on the ship. They had never seen a toilet. And so when they went to the bathroom, they went into the shower and squatted down and then pushed everything down the drain with their bare feet. That was interesting. Well, anyhow, we got up the road, and somewhere near Montélimar, I think it was, we came across a French railroad passenger train that had been derailed because the engine had been knocked out either by our artillery fire or by our aircraft. And this train, passenger trains, was ferrying concentration camp inmates from France to someplace in Germany. And the road, the side of the railroad was lined with these walking, and some of them couldn't walk, skeletons in striped pajamas. That made a deep impression on me. They were begging for food and water. We could give them water. We didn't dare give them our army rations. They wouldn't have. They would have made them sick immediately because they needed liquid food, probably intravenous, to restore their health if possible. But I reflected on that at the time and much since then.
How did that affect you and your friends?
Well, we realized that all the stories that we had heard about the concentration camps were not exaggerated. Because, you know, stories about the enemy oftentimes are exaggerated. And that wasn't.
Did you talk to
those guys convinced us that what the concentration camp must have been like. They were starved.
Did you talk to any of them?
Mm-mm. No, they could make signs. That was about all. I didn't. We gave them water. Our troops gave them water. I wasn't involved in that. I was there. Mm-hmm. But they were begging for food, too. So, we... catch up with my notes here.
Can I ask you how you kept in touch with your family during the time you were in Europe?
Email. Nah. It was actually airmail. But it was called email, incidentally enough. I'm going to interrupt this here and just get something and show you.
Okay. I'll pause this. We are resuming recording.
I want to talk about some of my training at Camp Hewlin in Texas and what it led to. I was assigned to teach aircraft recognition to our battalion, to the gunners mainly. Well, they gave me a training manual, an Army training manual. It was worthless, absolutely worthless. The only enemy planes shown in there were biplanes from the 1930s or earlier. So what I did was went to Life magazine, which we got regularly, and they had pictures of Messerschmitts, Zeros, Focke Wulfs, and so on. And so I cut out those pictures and mounted them on charts, and I tried to teach aircraft recognition. My audience was not too receptive. I remember one sergeant saying, "Well, Lieutenant, we're going to look for suns or crosses, those markings." And I said, "Yeah, that's true. If you can see those, but if it's coming at you 250, 300 miles an hour out of the sun, you better be able to recognize a silhouette to know what's coming or passing." And it got tested when we were offshore Sicily. We were waiting to go into land, and we had a couple of our guns mounted on deck of the LST. I was in the headquarters there or something, and one of our guns started firing. I came out as quickly as I could, and they were shooting at Spitfires. And wasn't used to hollering. I just grabbed the gunner, because it's a lever that you pull to fire. I just pulled him off of there and said, "Those are Spitfires." And they sort of looked at me. And wasn't long after that that I spotted some Messerschmitt 109s coming. And I pointed and yelled, "Target," the way you should. They sort of looked at me, and the gun crew, and eventually they got on the gun and started shooting. By then, the Messerschmitts were out of range and had already dropped their bombs. Fortunately, they didn't hit anything. But my crew was not that well trained as I'd been training. I didn't think I was very successful as an aircraft recognition teacher. But later on, I think it was in France, and I don't remember where exactly when, but one foggy morning, the fog lifted, and usually foggy, cloudy days was when the Luftwaffe came out, because they figured our fighters wouldn't be there to get them. And the P-47 came in at low altitude. You could see the bombs in his racks. And some people started shooting at him. And he went down. And I checked our guns, and one of our gun crews said, "We fired two rounds and recognized it was our own aircraft and ceased firing." An adjacent unit reported one Focke Wulf 190 shot down, coordinates. I got into trouble with our colonel. At that time, he was a major bucket for colonel. And I don't remember just what time it, where it was, but one of my duties as battery exec was to run around and verify kills, aircraft shot down. And a report came in from our various gun crews that something like 13 or 14 enemy planes had been shot down. Well, I went around to each gun, and they had kept good records of the azimuth, that is the direction, where they, and the time when they fired, and where the kill landed, where it hit. And it was perfectly obvious that they were, multiple guns were claiming each kill. So I went back to the colonel and said, not 13 or 14, but it's three. And that was the report I turned in. Well, I got the worst chewing out I ever got in the Army, because he was bucking for promotion. And he wanted that, those big numbers. And I was foolish enough to think that some of the geniuses running the war would really like to know how many aircraft the Luftwaffe had lost that day. But it, looking back on it, it was funny. Sure as hell wasn't funny at the time. So anyhow,
what year are we in now?
We're in 44.
Okay.
We're in France, and we're up near the German border, probably in Alsace-Lorraine. We had passed through the Severn Gap, which had never been taken from the west, the west direction. It's a gap through the Vosges Mountains. And actually, it was the Free French Armored Corps that took it. And those guys were unstoppable. They would load up on wine, get in their tanks, and they were going to go. And we'd come across a strong point. You see one or two, they had the old Sherman tanks that we'd given them. They were not our best model, not the latest model. Sherman tanks with a hole in them where they'd been through the turret, something knocked out. And then eventually we'd come to a knocked out pillbox because they'd just gone on. And they took it. So in the Severn Gap, one of the things that happened was a bunch of gendarmes, French gendarmes, who were acting as Free French, showed up at our headquarters. And they said that there were some Germans that wanted to surrender up in the mountains. They had located them, but they wouldn't surrender to the Free French. They would surrender to an American officer. So Colonel Schutz looked at me and said, "You're it. Go with them." So they used our trucks to transport, get us up in the mountain. And we got up in the mountains and got out of the trucks after driving as far as we could, and walked up a trail and spread out in a line, and the gendarmes blowing their little whistle, tweet, 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 and the fog was thick. We couldn't see 20 feet, maybe, in front of us. It was an uneasy feeling, but we never did find those Germans. I don't know whether they got back to their own lines or surrendered somewhere else. I don't know what happened to them. But the interesting thing was the French gendarmes spoke German. They didn't speak French. Our Colonel Schutz spoke good German. He was able to communicate with them when they got to the CP there. After the Franco-Prussian War, I believe it was, Germany controlled Lorraine, and the French took it back in World War I. And the things that were most scary to me, I was most concerned about, were the Holtz mines, and these were cardboard mines. You couldn't detect with a mine detector. You had to probe for them. And shoe mines, which were similar. These were little things the size of a matchbox with just enough explosive to take your foot off. And so I was always in the habit, and my Jeep driver was good at this, drive, never go off the shoulder, never get on the shoulder of the road. Stay in the road where the traffic is. And if you're walking, try to find a tank track and walk on that where the tank's been traveling. And at one point, we were in a bivouac. It was a poor choice. I would have never bivouacked there because it was right where a German strong point had been. Okay, and we had pulled up there, and there was a truck stuck in the mud in front of where the tent, CP tent, was going to be. And three guys, so happened the three that had been in that explosion, were out there trying to help, and all of a sudden the truck moved and hit a Holtz mine, and it knocked those three out cold. They were sent to the hospital, and but they weren't harmed. They were back the same day, but they got Purple Hearts, and we kidded them a lot about their bloodless Purple Hearts. About 3 weeks later, they were on the same three were on reconnaissance, and they made a mistake. They tried to turn around, they hit a stack of mines, killed all three of them. And I wondered if they had been mentally impaired by all those concussions that they had had. So that the driver and the sergeant and the lieutenant, because my driver and I would never have, we would have backed up for 5 miles if necessary. Never would have turned off the side of the road to turn around. It could have been our own minds, I don't know. But after the war ended, we were stationed near Munich, München, the German name, and the wind shifted, and we smelled death. And of course, what that was Dachau, the largest of the camps. And some of our guys went over there to look at it. I was a coward. I'd seen enough of that. I didn't care to go. But they described the bodies stacked up like cordwood, and skeletons, like they were so thin. All of the living ones had been evacuated to hospitals, but the place was loaded with dead. And that's what we had smelled. One thing in war, you learn that human bodies smell different from cows and camels. different odor. So, meanwhile, I'd been promoted to captain. Kind of courtesy promotion. But then some interesting things happened. We were shipped back to England to be demobilized. And when we got back to England, they transferred, by the way, we were all given points for months of overseas service. Each month we'd get a point, some number of points, for medals of various kinds, you get points. And so all of our low point guys were transferred out of our unit, by that time I was a battery commander, out of our battery to be shipped to Japan, to invade Japan. Well, of course, what happened, they were en route and the war ended. And so they went home and we're stuck. And 9 million troops have to be, and you can't do that overnight. And we didn't know when we'd get out of there. And I had guys come into my office, captain, tears running down their face. When are we going home? And all I could say was, we're gonna go home, I guarantee it. But I can't tell you when just yet. Now, meanwhile, you've got a good record. Don't spoil it. And I was also suggesting they go to town and have some fun. But one of our tasks was to move some munitions around, because I guess the Brits had munitions scattered in a lot of different places. And we were moving them all to one place, and we were using German prisoners to do that. We were supervising. We had a prison camp there, and the Germans were in charge of them. And one day, my prison loading, moving detail, munitions moving detail came back, and they all of a sudden they realized they were too short. Two guys were missing. I said, oh boy, we're in trouble now. Me too, because I'm in command. And so I got a detail together and had them just about ready to take off and go look for these two guys. In comes a taxi, and out steps the two prisoners. They didn't want to leave camp. They get good food and shelter. It all goes back to that thing, if you treat prisoners well, it pays you. And I hate to see what's going on in our now. And I empathize with these soldiers who don't know who the enemy is or where they are. There's enough mental strain to be in battle, and I was not in any serious. We got shelled and bombed a few times and so on, but nothing really intense. And there's enough of strain, and then add to that, you don't know who's your enemy and who's your friend. In fact, the Afghanistan soldiers right beside you may be waiting for a chance to kill you. That's got to, no wonder the suicides are so high in the Army now. As I described one suicide, a guy before we ever went overseas. That's the only suicide we had, as far as I know. We had other mental cases where they got mental discharges.
Were you ever worried about yourself in that way?
Well, I had trouble adjusting when I got back to civilian life. I took a job right away, but civilian work seemed trivial. I'd been making life and death decisions for almost 3 years, and it was hard, and I was drinking too much. And some friends of the family suggested that I go back to school. And so I did. I took a GI Bill and got another degree, and a master's degree. And that helped me. And going back to school like that, also I met that woman there.
62 years we've been married.
And once, incidentally, I see all the newspaper stories about people griping about their taxes. When I got back in October of 45, I owed 4 years income taxes. I was grateful that they hadn't bothered me with it while I was busy on other things. They postponed, but I owed taxes for 1942, 43, 44, and 45. And with combat pay, I was getting pretty good pay for those days, pretty good money. And I don't remember exactly, but I think it was between $1,500 and $2,000. And a friend of the family who was a CPA, and he was one-armed, he had lost an arm in World War I, he helped me prepare my income tax. And then I went back to school on the GI Bill. Well, I thought those taxes were annoying, but I had seen all the waste that war causes and the costs of war. And to me, I was getting something back. I was getting a GI Bill. Helped me get another degree and find a good job and get married and raise a family.
What was your degree and where?
University of Alabama again, and the degree was in organic chemistry. My previous degree had been in commercial chemistry, which is a hybrid between business and chemistry, which was useful in my job with DuPont.
Okay. Did you keep in touch with the people that you served with?
To some degree, yeah. I didn't get into the reunion. You asked about, these were my letters home. I didn't know my mother had saved all these. And it's not, of course, it's not, I said email. It's V-mail. V-mail.
V-mail.
Yeah, it's a little letter. And you see it? That's typical. And censored?
Uh-huh.
I censored my own. I hated that job. Of all the duties I had as an officer, I hated censoring mail. Because I had to read the letters that guys were sending home, and I felt like I was intruding on their personal life. But that was required.
What did people write about when they wrote home?
Well, how's everything, and you know, I miss you, and this and that and other. They could say very little about where they were or what was going on. That was against the rules.
Mm-hmm. What did you write home about?
See one of these emails. Here's one I sent to my father. Dear Dad, well, I haven't been too regular in writing lately. One reason is that I mislaid my V-mail forms for a while, but I have some more now. Another is we can't say much at all. I guess I can write about the flowers here. They are mostly red poppies. Big as your fist, and all of them are as thick as wheat in the wheat field. where yellow daisies and so forth grow in between. The landscape varies from light green of spring wheat to dark green of rye to yellow of the daisies to orange where poppies are mixed with daisies. I'm well and waxing colorful. Then to stark crimson where poppies grow alone. The climate is now much milder, being very like in most respects to late May at home. However, it sometimes most reminds me of cedar hammock in November when the limb chickens begin to hide. I'm talking about squirrels, because I used to hunt squirrels as a kid. They're really good eating. If you can save enough gas coupons, please catch a big one down at Big Lake. Big fish, I'm talking about. For me, I'm going fishing in one of these creeks around here one of these days without any lines or bait. Either. If the game warden doesn't catch me, I'll borrow a hunk of TNT from the engineers. I'm not proud of that, but I did do that one time. I got some TNT and attached an Italian hand grenade to it. Pulled the pin on the hand grenade and threw it out there in the creek to stun some fish. That's not a good way to go fishing. I wasn't proud of that, but I did it.
When you got home, how was describing the experience to your friends and family that weren't abroad? What was that like?
Well, I was very shy about talking. My children all said that I wouldn't talk about my experiences for a long time. The reason was I felt guilty. I'd been in 7 campaigns and 2 invasions and not gotten a stretch at all. I'd just been plain lucky. First of all, lucky to land in the unit that I landed in, and lucky in when our ship got torpedoed, I was on shore, and lucky many, many other times. So, you know, they were going to convert us to armored artillery, and as I've related, the Air Corps made a mistake, and the Luftwaffe took advantage of us, and we were converted back to AAA.
Do you feel like, clearly you're a young adult during the time that you were abroad, so how do you feel that you changed as a person between training and when you got home? It's a deep question, I know.
Trying to remember. Well, as I said, I thought that civilian jobs and work seemed trivial. It took me a while. And getting married helped because I knew I had to make a living, because women didn't work in those days. And they stayed at home, tended to children. And so that was my objective, to get a good job, and I did. And I was successful. I was a middle-level manager with DuPont. By the way, middle-level managers became an endangered species. I took early retirement. I never regretted that, because after retirement, I really worked on environmental issues and wrote hundreds of op-eds, volunteer op-eds. I had a weekly column in a newspaper in New Smyrna Beach, where we were.
Why did you decide to go into environmentalism like that?
Well, I don't know. I'd grown up enjoying hunting and fishing and outdoors, And when we moved to Florida, we bought a place on the water, on a creek, on a dredged creek. And there was a big marsh across the way. And some people questioned, they said, why'd you buy a place looking out on that big swamp? You could have bought it on the other side of the road and had a view of all the yachts and condos. And I said, well, we kind of like that outdoor look. And I began to realize soon that all of that wildlife that we enjoyed was not going to be there for our children and grandchildren. Where we were, we had a dock, and our children would come down and love to go fishing with me, and we would catch crabs off the dock. We had crab traps, and they enjoyed that. The grandchildren particularly enjoyed the crabbing. It was the realization that things I had taken for granted were disappearing. And one thing led to another. It started out just, I heard that the swamp across the way was going to be developed, and I looked around for a citizens association. There was none, but Catherine played bridge a lot, and one of the bridge people was also a mayor, and she was president of the local Audubon chapter. So I said, oh, I'll go to them. Next thing you know, I'm Audubon chapter president. One thing leads to another, you know how that goes. And I'm looking at now at national issues, and I very soon became interested in climate change because I see that as a real threat to Florida. I don't think people recognize it. But I wrote a column one time where I said, Floridians are going to have to learn to like porpoises and whales were originally land dwellers, and they just took to the water and developed fins. They still breathe air, of course, but that's the heritage from dwelling on land. I said, maybe Floridians will have to develop fins because the sea level is going to rise if we don't do something about our emissions. And I still believe that. And the big threat, of course, is the ice on Greenland, which is melting at ever-increasing speed.
That's all the questions that I have. Do you have anything you want to add?
No, I guess not. I've loaded up your machine.
I'm gonna stop the recorder now.
Okay.